All right, welcome everybody. This is, believe it or not, episode 11 of Talking Cloud. Yeah, we've made it. I guess we should have been more excited about episode 10, but I didn't realize it was episode 10. So I figured this time I'd do it. Episode 10. So as usual, I'm Brett, and I'm here with...
Travers.
I was trying to point. That didn't work well at all. A mirrored thing. And we're back to tell you all the great stuff that's happened this week in AWS. And I say cloud news, but it's pretty much Gen AI news at this point, right?
It's predominantly that these days. I guess that's where all the interest is.
Well, how many times did we talk about it today alone? Just
no kidding.
In the group, probably at least twice, maybe three times.
Yeah. At least.
So, yeah. And the weather has gone in the exact opposite direction from yesterday. It's a balmy 8 degrees here today versus, what, -8 yesterday, I think? Somewhere around
it's
there?
It's full spring part two. So.
Yeah. So here we go. All right. So... enough of that. Let's hop right in and see if all of this works. There we go. So our first thing, and I was saying to you before we started the stream today, I got a little more organized. Last week, we were kind of jumping between industry news and AWS news. So I decided that I would just kind of lay it all out in order here. So we're going to start with all of the, at least the stuff that I thought was interesting on the AWS updates. And most of it is sort of related to things that we see our customers using on a regular basis. So here's the first one. If you're running an RDS multi-AZ deployment with two readable standbys, you can now get support for GP3 storage volumes. Okay.
Great.
Yeah, great. Yeah. Better than GP2, right? Better performance, lower per hour cost or lower per gig cost. So that's good. And to be honest, when I saw this one, it kind of caught me by surprise. I was like, oh, I didn't realize that it didn't support GP3.
No kidding. Yeah, you would think that RDS as a managed service would incorporate the latest in the drive tech, but I guess maybe it takes some doing to add a new drive type.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that's... I've often said, I've been working on AWS for a long time now, and I love the fact that it's always evolving, always changing, new stuff, but I've often described it as a double-edged sword, right? It's great that we have all these new bells and whistles and toys that you can go and check out, but it's also really challenging with so many changes. So this actually caught me off guard while I was teaching a class. And I'm perfectly okay to admit that even from a teacher's perspective, instructor's perspective, it's really hard to stay up to date on all this stuff. So I was actually doing a demo of RDS, and you've always had single AZ deployments and multi AZ deployments, right?
Right.
And I'm going through the demo and I'm like, what's this? And I can't remember what engine it was now, but they have the concept of, I want to say in the console, it was called a DB cluster, where you could have a primary node with multiple standby nodes now. So when I was reading this, I kind of made the assumption here that the GP3 storage volume support was for that particular implementation where you're doing the DB cluster deployment of RDS that prior to now, it only supported GP2.
Okay.
That's kind of what I thought, but I'm not completely convinced. As always with these things, I always have plans to test some of this stuff out before the stream, and then I'm like, how is it Friday already? Right? It's like March 1st. I'm like, I don't know where time is going, but I think that's what this is.
It's totally flown by. Reads to me like they're added it for this particular solution in RDS. You can now use GP3, which gives you storage performance independent of capacity.
Yeah.
So you can fine tune for your IOPS.
Yeah, you can fine tune that. But you still get that baseline performance, right? Of what is it here? 3,000 IOPS. And then you can
scale up to 64
on what you need, right? Yeah. 64,000 IOPS. So I think this is great. Like, you know, we often see a lot of EC2 instances running older instance types, right? But also older storage types as well. Let's call them type storage class or whatever you want to call it.
Right.
Like, you know, I've actually run into, believe it or not, a couple magnetic drives not to long ago. Yeah, including a magnetic drive on an RDS database. We were doing a review of an account for a customer, and I was running all the scripts and stuff, and you know, it's funny how you get into autopilot with some of the stuff. So I'm going through all the output, and I basically create a filter to just highlight the different storage types, and yep. I just have them color coded so I can kind of just get through it all and find the stuff that stands out. And I think I have the magnetic storage types in my CSV files. I import them. I think they show up as yellow. So I was just scrolling through the list. Okay. I'm like, what's yellow? And I went and I looked. I'm like, oh, old magnetic drive. So they still do exist. But, you know, using the latest and greatest, whether it's instance types or storage volumes, are always going to give you better performance for lower cost, right? So this
for
is a
the
good
dollar,
one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Check your RDS instances.
Yes.
Which GP2 types or which storage types are you using?
Especially if they've been kicking around for a while, right?
Yeah, you yeah. probably, without even realizing it, you've probably got some opportunity there to improve the performance and lower the cost. Not necessarily a trivial exercise, depending on what you're doing, but
no.
it should be something that's on your list, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Now, this reminds me, just because we're talking RDS, there were those couple changes. There are, what was it now? End of life support for MySQL, which I guess we're well past now because we're into March.
Yeah.
So if you've got MySQL 5.7 running in RDS, you're now on extended support, which is going to increase your costs. So you should check that. And then there is the still upcoming RDS cert changes, right?
Yes.
Which I think I saw you making changes in a customer's account. Was it today or yesterday? They were verifying
today.
That everything was okay. Today.
Yep. Just this morning we did a change for that. So check your cert authorities because those are expiring as well.
Yeah. I would suspect that type of work is going to happen all year as people stumble across this and have those oh shit moments. I better change that, right?
I would think so. I think there's going to be some fun surprises for a lot of people. So
okay, so here's a question. I probably should know the answer to this. What happens, like, that cert doesn't expire till the end of the year, right? What happens if you don't change your database cert, RDS database cert, by, let's say, November, whatever that expiry date is? What would happen?
It depends on whether you're using it for authentication, right? Mm. If you're actually using the RDS cert for authentication, then it can cause some problems.
Because your clients, at that point, the cert's no longer valid and the clients won't connect properly, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So there you go. A few things to think about, a few new features that you might not have known about, and a few ongoing operational tasks that you probably should just double check in your environment if you haven't already looked and you're running RDS.
Yeah. Doesn't hurt to take a look.
Doesn't hurt to take a look. Next up. Sorry, I don't know why my little streaming program here just rearranged all my windows. There we go. Let's try this again. I'm going to zoom into this. I'm just realizing it's a little on the small side. Try to get that a little better. There we go. So NoSQL Workbench. You and I were talking about, you know, I always find this funny when we're collecting these articles and stuff. How many times does an article come up that isn't directly related, but it tends to be something that we talked about? You and I were just talking about using NoSQL Workbench, and what was the tool you were testing out to help you with this?
I was looking at something called Dynobase.
Dynobase, that's it. Yeah.
And same kind of idea as the NoSQL Workbench, right? A tool to give you a GUI to work with DynamoDB as resources.
Yeah, I never tested out Dynobase. I think I downloaded it and then I got distracted by something else and never made it back to it. But I really do like the NoSQL Workbench. It's kind of my go-to tool for when I'm dealing with DynamoDB and things like that. And just another new feature here. So you can now clone tables within your Workbench and keep all, I think the interesting part here is copying key attributes and options to global secondary indexes, capacity settings. So it's basically replicating that table for you.
Yeah.
So you can develop and test your code with DynamoDB tables. It's kind of neat. Right?
That's excellent. That's great. Yeah. Well, that you can, it gives you a development table essentially to mess around with or back up a table, that kind of stuff. That's a good thing to have in your toolkit.
Yeah. And the other thing here is, I'm just going to highlight this, DynamoDB local. I always kind of shoulder shrug this. I'm like, who cares? Like,
oh, yeah.
I, I've got a DynamoDB table running in AWS already. I'll just connect to that and blah, blah, blah. And I was working on a URL shortener for our little training roadmap stuff. So we can kind of see what's happening, who's clicking what and stuff like that. And I got to tell you, I don't even know what made me decide to do it, but I was like, I'm just going to turn on DynamoDB local for this. It's no different. It's DynamoDB, right? But there was just something about it that made the development process, I think, a little more streamlined than normal. I don't know how to articulate it, but it just was a really handy little tool to have as part of the workbench. And in theory, I guess if I didn't have Wi-Fi connection or something, I could still plug away on my DynamoDB table and, you know, do my testing and stuff. So that was kind of neat.
For sure. And if it's running locally, you reduce any latency. Not that there's a ton of latency hitting Dynamo, right? But it's also really good if you're developing an app with the SAM, like the serverless deployment tool at AWS.
Yeah, of course, because SAM's got all those local testing options too, right? So you can point it at your DynamoDB local instance.
That's like one of the best use cases for it I've found. But it's a great tool.
Yeah. So if you're looking for a GUI tool that you could use to help you build your NoSQL solutions, including Dynamo. It also doesn't DynamoDB or doesn't works. Wow, let me try this again. I'm thinking about all the other services. Doesn't NoSQL Workbench also support? Doesn't it support some? Is it Keybase or something? It supports something more than just Dynamo, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm not sure honestly.
Yeah, okay.
I have to check.
In my brain, when you fire it up. When you first start the application up, you get a couple options, and I thought it was Keybase.
Is it like Mongo or something, or DocumentDB even?
Yeah, I can't remember. But if you're looking for a tool, I think for me, you know, we often say to people the most, at least for me, the most important part about working with DynamoDB is ensuring that you've got good key structure from the very beginning, that you're as best as you can, you know, covering, evenly distributing the read and write work across that key structure. So being able to use something like Workbench or a different tool to help you visualize that and run through your use cases and stuff, I use it all the time.
Yeah, that's so important for working with Dynamo tables, right? Especially when you get to scale. You don't want any hot records in your DB. So knowing that structure is kind of essential.
Well, and this is, again, like we were talking about, if you were running even DynamoDB local, now you could run through your use cases without any latency, without any additional cost. Not that DynamoDB is an expensive service, but you could do that all locally on your development workstation, test everything out, fine-tune stuff, and then decide how you want to get that into your AWS account, whether you do that through Workbench or some other way, right? So pretty good tool there. And it's free.
And it's free.
Free's good.
That's good. Yeah. I mean, you pay for the tables, right? But
pay for the tables, but the tool is free, right?
The tool is free.
Yeah. So this one caused quite a stir last week on X or Twitter, whatever you want to call it. You know, just a few people were talking about this. So CloudFront announces availability of embedded points of presence. So new type of infrastructure that is deployed even closer to your end users or end viewers within ISPs and mobile network operators. So you're getting even closer to the ultimate destination, right? The origin of that call.
Okay, this must come from those edge racks that they were talking about a couple of years ago, where you could deploy a mini AWS cloud at the edge, I'm wondering.
Maybe,
so now you have the edge, and you have the bleeding edge in the ISP, I guess.
Yeah, you're getting one step closer. I always find trying to keep all of this stuff straight, I always have to go back and look at the documentation. So, like, I know CloudFront, okay, so we can use these embedded points of presence now. I still think the closest you can get to a customer would still be a local zone, would it not? So is a local zone closer to a customer than an embedded point of presence in CloudFront? I don't know.
That's a great question. I'm not sure. If it is at the ISP level, like it's in their data center, theoretically, I mean, that could be a lot closer, right?
Yeah.
But in AWS, the closest you're going to get is the local zone.
Yeah. Or actually, is it? I guess if you ran a Oh, what's it called now? Where you put a stack in your own data center.
Oh yeah, the edge location. Or,
yeah, or, there's a name for the. It's a physical piece of hardware. You either have a 1U server, 2U server, I think it is, or a 42U rack. I should know the name of it, but it's escaping me. I guess that's, in theory, the absolute closest. An outpost, thank you.
That's what it is, yeah.
So you could put an outpost server or an outpost rack would be, I guess, the closest
get. Yeah, that's what I think this must be, is an outpost that you have in other data centers.
Like AWS has installed an outpost in an ISP somewhere, maybe.
Like Verizon or something like that, yeah.
My goal was always to get a 1U outpost server in my basement. just because, but if I recall, just to say I have it for some sort of weird flex, which is really kind of stupid. I guess it's kind of like the same sort of flex as I've got all the certs. And I was really disappointed because I think I read even if you have, if you go down the server path, you still need enterprise support. So
gotcha.
I might have been able to squeak the cost of the server through, but I don't think I'm going to be able to handle 15K a month just to have a 1U server in my basement. But anyways, yeah, so that dashed my dreams of having an outpost in my basement.
Oh man. But
for what? I have no idea, but just to say. And you also had to make a 12-month commitment. So I was kind of, you know, I was like, oh, I could put it in my basement for a couple months and then just send it back. Nope.
No.
So, yeah. Anyway, so we've got here, you can see it's got 600 plus embedded points of presence deployed across 200 cities. So lots of infrastructure here that you can use. So there we go. Obviously, there's way more interesting interesting news updates from AWS, but these are the three that sort of stuck out at me over the week. Okay. So let's change gears. Let's go from AWS news to Gen AI, because it's much all Gen AI. We need some sort of weird transition right there, like some fancy music that, right?
Some sort of segment transition.
Yeah. Fancy animation or something. I shared this in the news editor last week, and I decided to put it into, did we talk about this in the podcast? I don't think we did.
I don't think we did, no.
I think I jammed this in on the Monday morning newsletter, which I will share a link for before we're done, if I can do it quickly enough. Just shamelessly plug, you should sign up for our weekly newsletter. I loved this article. It's corporate Ozempic. I think the thing that stuck out to me about this was Scott Galloway, Prof G, is sort of just saying something that I think a lot of people think but don't say. And he even says in here, like, how CEOs right now are not really talking about the fact that this is what AI is all about. But eventually one of them will come out, and at that point the floodgates open, and every CEO of a large company will say, yes, we are using Gen AI in ways to essentially get more productivity out of a smaller workforce. That's essentially what this article is all about. What do you think?
And we're going to see it in some of the other articles as well. But basically the thesis is that the efficiency gains you get from using Gen AI technology lets you spend less on employment, right? Or workforce.
Yeah.
So I think it's to me, it reads like it's definitely a factor. Like, it could be related to some of the layoffs we're seeing in tech recently.
And that's sort of the point that he makes in here too, is he's like, okay, so the layoffs last year were because a lot of these large technology companies just simply overhired during the pandemic.
Yeah.
Right. And they were then scaling back their workforces after that period of crazy hiring. And his thesis here is that the layoffs that we're seeing now are due to Gen AI, the fact that they've streamlined their workforce, gotten rid of those excessive hires, and now they're realizing the gains of using a Gen AI tool and being able to remove employees and get better productivity. So
yeah. And obviously, like everything else, it's a mix of factors, right? But I could definitely see that being a reasonable thing to say is causing these layoffs, right, or having an impact.
I would definitely think it's probably influencing some of the decision making that's happening, right?
It's probably having a pretty large effect.
I would think so. I would think so. And then if you remember last week, we talked about a particular company that I won't mention again. But when they were seeing such huge productivity gains from something like Code Whisperer, if you flip that conversation around and take it from the lens of this article, you could then see how potentially or possibly you could take those great gains from something like a programming, an assistant like that, and then say, well, do we need all of these people if we've got this great tool that provides fantastic suggestions and our teams are using those suggestions half of the time anyways? Maybe we could shrink up the size of that team. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to be really interesting.
Yeah. Interesting. Interesting. And that is a perfect segue into this. I pointed this one out to you in particular. Did you have a chance to get through this article?
The Klarna one? Yes. Yeah. This was very interesting. Again, kind of in the same vein as that last article, Corporate Ozempic, and kind of like the realization of what everyone was predicting was going to happen when OpenAI first launched ChatGPT, right? Yeah. But it's this company, Klarna. They have a customer service chat assistant, essentially, is the business model. And you can train it on your company's data and give it tasks to handle customer service requests. It's really incredible. It's done the equivalent work of 700 full-time agents, 2.3 million conversations, two-thirds of all of their customer service chat. It's insane. Customer service is getting disrupted, I guess, is the best way to put it.
But yeah, I would use a stronger word. It's going to get destroyed.
Demolished.
Demolished, destroyed. There's lots of words that begin with a D that we could use here. But yeah, to your point,
wow.
Insane. And I've got the article up. I think the thing that really struck me about this article, and again, it's something that sort of relates back to the corporate Ozempic thing that we just talked about with Prof G, is the fact that we have stats here that exactly what they say in the first sentence, the numbers speak for themselves. It's equivalents, like you said, 700 full-time agents, drop in repeat inquiries. It's available 24 hours a day, 23 markets, 35 languages, and they even spell out an estimated improvement in profit of $40 million for the year.
Insanity. The languages thing really gets me because that's got to be one of the biggest issues with customer support is having localized support teams across that work in all these various languages you need to support. That's no longer a problem.
Yeah.
You have this robot that can talk in whatever language you can program.
35 languages. Right? Yeah. And that's only going to improve over time, right? They're going to add to that as it gets better. Yeah.
As language models get trained on additional more languages, right, up to up to a point. And
It's funny, like, to draw some more analogies, when cloud first started, AWS had this lead where everybody thought, although nobody's going to do that, that's crazy, why wouldn't I just keep my virtual machines and my physical machines in my own data center? So they had this nice lead of multiple years where everybody just thought they were batshit crazy, and then suddenly everybody realized, oh crap. Looking at this article powered by OpenAI, I know we're not talking, because everybody's scrambling this point to play catch up with, and again, my opinion, you tell me if I'm wrong here, but it seems to me that OpenAI is clearly the leader in this space, because everything I read is powered by OpenAI, powered by OpenAI. So it's amazing to see how it's sort of flipped on its head, where AWS was the leader in sort of cloud computing in general, and now OpenAI's come out of nowhere and everybody else is playing catch up. Now they don't have a multi-year lead where they're able to go off and do their own thing and nobody notices, but I think everybody's playing catch up to them. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, it's what it looks like, right? Maybe the closest it would be Google with their Gemma models that they just released. Yeah. But yeah, it's mind blowing. It looks like from the numbers an industry just getting decimated, basically, right?
Yeah.
But obviously, you're still going to need to escalate calls to a human at some point. But
well, it goes back to what we talked about, I think, last week, right? Where a person was talking to the chatbot gave him advice, and it was advice with a financial impact that ended up not being true, and the company ran into some trouble. So yeah, there's probably still that handoff, but there's you don't need 700 agents to do that, because the likelihood of of 90%, I'm making a number up, but like the vast majority of those requests probably are the same thing every time, and the bot would get really good at just answering those and getting that person on their way, right, and happy with the response.
There's definitely a subset of customer service tasks that are easy to automate, I would imagine, right? Yeah, like account checking and information changing.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting. This is like it done correctly versus the other example that we saw where the chatbot was didn't seem to have any oversight for the financial information. But you can build that in, right? You can build in the ability to check and reference that data.
Yeah. So I would say there's probably going to be some hard lessons learned over the next 6 to 8 months. And the chatbot that we were talking about last week, I think, is a good example of a hard lesson that, let's be honest, not just that company is going to go through this year. There's so much learning to be done here. And with all of the, I don't want to call it unknowns, but it's just with everything moving so fast, mistakes are going to be made, and things like what we talked about last week are going to happen. You're going to have some situations where customers aren't happy, and you're going to realize that your AI assistant, I keep calling it a chatbot, but I guess it's more than a chatbot at this point.
Yeah,
it's an AI assistant. Your AI assistant was just wrong. It made a mistake, right? Which I guess, in fairness, people do all the time as well. Could probably find an example of a human person telling you something that is not necessarily like 100% true. And, it's not done on purpose. It's just people make mistakes. And obviously so do these. Right. I love this article. Like, I had to read it a couple times because I'm like, holy hell.
Like, it's kind of unbelievable, right? Yeah. Like if you just looking at it the first read through, it's such a huge impact that this service has on a business's customer service load.
Yeah.
It's just staggering.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Again, it's a brand new field. I'm super interested to see how the security portion of this progresses over the next 2 years. Because one of the biggest concern for me for these things is that if you're talking to it in plain text, that's super vulnerable, right?
Yeah.
You can always have some nefarious actor come in with a jailbroken prompt and try and attack your system. So
yeah, it'll be interesting. We'll I guess that goes back to the lessons learned too, right? We have to figure this stuff out pretty quickly. Yeah,
for sure.
I'm going to skip over the Eureka one. We're going to come back to it in a second. But here is kind of another article about where there's some lessons still to be learned. And you know what? The thing that this goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning. How many times have we had a conversation and then it's like the universe listens to you and throws something back at you? We were having sort of an off the cuff, just totally theoretical conversation in the Slack channel. And somebody just made the comment about, oh yeah, you could just use ChatGPT for law. And then the next day this popped in. DC lawyer reprimanded for citing fake cases. And this is not the first time this has happened. I remember this article a couple times now, right? Like, or an article like this. So essentially, essentially they went into court with things that weren't true. And they've established since this happened that the lawyer, wasn't doing it on purpose, just sort of didn't realize that in some cases the AI may not actually be telling you the truth. And it's kind of like you and I have talked about a couple times over the last probably 10 episodes as we talk more and more about Gen AI is trust but verify. Trust but verify.
Yes.
Right?
Always verify.
So I'll include this. Yeah. Especially when you're dealing with stuff like this. I'll include this because I think it is, again, as much as the hype is fantastic about this and it's always fun to look at the new shiny things and try this stuff out. We've been trying it out ourselves, which I'm going to give another shameless plug here in a minute. But like you gotta just, you gotta trust but verify. You gotta figure out and make sure this stuff is right. And here's another instance of where somebody just took it for face value and it didn't work out very well.
Because they lost the case, right?
Lost the case, and I would assume that's probably not the end of it. I would suspect that they will take this kind of thing very seriously. Obviously, you know, they don't want to, well, they want to discourage this from happening again. So I think, unfortunately, for the person that was involved in here, it's probably not the end of it for them, but I don't know. I would suspect that there would be some other fallout from this, but read these things because it's important to make sure you understand what's possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is one you shared with me.
Yes. I found this one extremely interesting.
So walk us through it. I love, sorry, before you do that, I love the little byline in front of this or whatever. Here come the robots, right? So why don't you walk us through it? Give us the Cole's notes.
Okay. So the article is about training robots in simulated environments and using GPT-4 to fine-tune the mechanisms with which the robots are trained, essentially. So the idea is when you do reinforcement learning, when you train a machine or an agent to do a task, you have to write what's called a reward function, which basically tells the agent how good it's doing at its job, essentially. Mm-hmm. These are not easy to write for humans for complex systems. It gets really tricky really fast to optimize these agents. But what these guys are doing is they're leveraging NVIDIA's simulated environments, and they're passing the reward function feedback into ChatGPT, and they've conditioned it to spit out new reward functions to try. And it has actually resulted in some really staggering advances in robotics, it seems like.
Wow.
There's these videos. Yeah.
This video this here, interesting. Right?
Can you Are you see? On the hand one?
Yeah, I'm on the hand one.
So you have to think about this. How do you tell an agent what's a good way to spin a pen like this, right? Like, it has X outputs, right? It has motors in each of the joints, basically, or a tensioner that can control to actually control where the pen's going. Mm-hmm. But how do you know what's going to result in a good spin? It could just get locked up. But you can get ChatGPT to write those functions for you and iterate on that. And then you get, and then simulate it over 1,000 different hands sitting in cyberspace, right? And get a hand, a robotic hand that can do this in real life if you built it, because the environment is so tailored or so realistic, right? It models physics perfectly or close to perfectly. You get agents that can do real world tasks. There's this one robot that has like four wheels and it can rear up and pop open a door. It can pick up a box and throw it in another box, like. And that's all the result of this kind of reinforcement training in simulated environments. So this is, I think, one of the biggest deals that this kind of tech is going to bring us in the next, like, 20 years.
So, okay. Is this not then robots training robots?
Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't this the thing that we're supposed to be worried about? The robots are now training themselves and...
It's just just like limited,
is near.
Limited parameterized, you know.
Keep telling yourself
application.
That
application. It'll be fine, I'm sure.
It'll be, what's the worst that could happen? So here, I'm gonna play this. Wow.
Yeah.
And this is all self-taught by GPT-4. Basically building those reward mechanisms back to tell it, hey, this, you know, how to improve. Like, explain the reward mechanism a little more for me if you can.
Okay, so here's an example. There one good example I saw was someone trying to train an agent to play Pokemon. Are you mm-hmm. familiar
yep.
with the video game? Okay.
Yep.
So it's a we wanted to train it to get the agent as far into the game as possible. But how do you tell it what's a good way to do that? There's some screens. Usually, one way to do it is to try and get it to find new screens of the game that don't look the same, that have a lot of variation. That way you're progressing. But there's some issues that can pop up in that some screens have animated objects, and those are constantly changing. So that's a scene that's constantly changing. So it stops. It never moves. That kind of thing. It
doesn't know what to do with that.
Right, because the reward function is satisfied because it's constantly seeing novel screens. Okay. So that's the kind of thing you can run into with this, is you're the expected outcome of your reward functions could leave you in a bad state, basically.
Okay.
Or undesired state of what you actually want to get. You might get stuck in like a local maximum and so not then, be able to progress.
Okay, so then what's happening here is that GPT-4 is looking at the outcomes and reworking those rewards then to keep it moving forward to better train the robot. Is that essentially what's happening?
Essentially, yeah. So they've given it the context needed to write what does a reward function look like for this kind of situation, and given it some additional context for maybe how you can improve it, that kind of thing.
Okay.
And then, yeah, it receives the output of the simulation. Okay. And we'll write a new reward function for it.
Very cool. Pretty much get out of this. Very cool stuff. And I also, can I do this now? I'm under pressure. Can I do it? There we go. I taught myself this with, I don't know what my reward function was, but it was sitting at 3 o'clock in the morning in the back of a grocery shipping warehouse and didn't really have much else to do. And there we go. I can't do it the opposite direction, and my brain never could figure that out. But anyways, there we go. All right, this is really great stuff. I guess if you put your doom cap on, it's really great stuff, but also slightly scary. But I guess you could say the same thing about the AI assistant that's replacing call center jobs as well. I think this is like a radical shift in how people are going to, well, make a living and yeah, it's just going to be interesting to see how this all works out. Because wouldn't this be replacing human jobs as well? Like before, this type of training would happen in a physical environment and people would look at what's happening and then go back and try to restructure it and watch that physical machine do it again. Now it's all virtual and AI is restructuring those reward systems as they go.
We're going to see humanoid or not. It doesn't have to be humanoid, but worker robots in the next 5 years that are as good or better than a person.
We're recording this, so we're gonna see how close
we're
gonna you are.
See.
Yeah, we're gonna see how close you are. I don't doubt it at all. I'm thinking this thing is just gonna exponentially. It's gonna accelerate exponentially. I guess maybe is it even 5 years? Like. I don't know, but I'm with you.
I might be being conservative. With
that, maybe. Yeah. I used to, when we first started looking at stuff, I used the phrase earlier in the show, like kind of just shoulder shrugged it. I was like, oh, whatever. This is just another thing. Right. And as we've talked about it more and more, I have really changed my perspective on this, that this thing is, I call it a thing, but AI in general, Gen AI is just, it's going to radically change the entire world. It's going to be incredible to see what it does.
It really feels different this time. And it's like you said, this kind of feedback loop situation with the machine turning the machine is that has the potential to just go parabolic, right? Or exponential rather.
Yeah, right? Because it's way smarter than us and it's going to learn, and you would think that it would get smarter in every iteration, and before you know it, it's building robots that will exterminate us.
Yeah, I don't know about smart. Like, smarter is one thing, right? But it's like you can run.
But it's even, you know what? It's not necessarily scalable. Smarter, but it's scalable. This thing could run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Doesn't have to take a break. You know, it just keeps going. And I think that's really, you know, if you put your corporate hat on again and think about it from that perspective, that to me has got to be something that when you're thinking about bottom line and stuff like that, having something that can work nonstop forever, essentially, and constantly making small improvements over time, never stops. That's really enticing to figure out how you could use that to improve your own business, whatever it might be, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Nuts. This reminds me, I want to see here. Give me a second. So I've got a bunch of other articles that didn't make it in to this. Just bear with me a sec, because you said humanoid robots, and it made me think of something. And I won't pull it up right now because I want to save it for. I want to save it for the newsletter. Again, you can only get this on the newsletter. You really can't. You could just Google it and find it. But it is a Reuters article about a bunch of technology folks getting together and funding humanoid robots.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it's coming. And again, shameless plug here. Give me a second. Because I've talked about it and I said I will share it. If you want to... How do I do this? Here's the question, right?
Mm.
Yeah, the big question is, can I actually do what I would want to do here? This is where we need some elevator music again, right? As I'm trying to figure out how this works.
You're trying to throw it in like
I'm trying to throw it in chat. Click on it.
Oh,
interview chat. I see. There's way too many options here. I need an AI assistant to help us with this. Okay, let's see if this works. I don't know if that is actually in chat or not. It isn't. Well, you know what? I'm going to give it one more shot. This program is fantastic. It has so many options that I'm like, yeah, it's probably one of these. Yeah, we'll throw it into here. Can I do it? I'll do it later. I can't be bothered. I've lost interest already. And the last article for today is automating tasks using Amazon Bedrock agents and AI. And we've talked about this sort of AI agents before. And this kind of caught my attention. And I thought we could talk about it here. I'm going to rely again on your expertise on this, but this idea of using agents, I think this first sentence sums this up perfectly, right?
Yeah.
Using Amazon Bedrock agents to empower you to construct and customize autonomous agents within your company that can perform tasks on your behalf. And we were talking about this not too long ago. I think I watched a YouTube video or something where the person was using, it wasn't Bedrock, it was another tool, and they were like creating agents, and they had like a marketing agent. So it was AI that was acting as the marketing person. AI is acting as like the search engine optimization expert. And they had built out like a series of agents and then said, they gave it a task and the agents worked together to output sort of whatever the task was. I think it was something like improve the copy on this web page or something like that. Yeah. That's essentially what we're talking about here, correct?
Pretty much, yeah. It's essentially what's going on here. This is kind of a walkthrough of how you can go and set up your own agent for accomplishing various tasks. It's kind of it seems like a good practice. It's kind of the best practice way to deploy this kind of thing, like we were talking about.
Yeah.
It gives it a little bit of some guardrails, some data retrieval options for sensitive data. Like you could point it to a policy database or if you wanted to book an appointment or something, a bookings database, that kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
And then it wouldn't get that data. It wouldn't hallucinate that data.
Okay.
So.
Now here's a question. For the last, I don't know, 3-4 weeks, I've been tooling around with the Amazon Q, the Gen AI assistant there. And it's really interesting. I've got it tied to a bunch of different data sources now. So last week, it had been tied to our website for a while. And then last week, I tied it to our Slack workspace. And it was able to pull in Slack information. Excuse me. The one thing that I didn't do is Q also has this idea of, I don't want to call it a guardrail, because what I'm thinking about I don't think is a guardrail, but it has, so it has all these crawlers or connectors, and that's how you tie it to all these data sources, right? And as part of these connectors, it has an identity crawler. So the idea behind the identity crawler is it creates its own user store within Q. My understanding of it is that, like, let's say you authenticate, so it knows Travers versus Henry versus Brett. And then depending on our access rights in these different tools, Jira, Slack, like think of all the different connectors it can talk to. You can include the identity crawler, which would then create sort of, you made me think of it when you had said about sort of putting policy in place so it can't see certain documents and things like that, or at least you can't see those documents. Is that what you kind of meant when you, I didn't catch exactly what you said, but that idea of sort of guardrails and sort of protecting information that you didn't necessarily want your agents to be able to see. Is that the same thing, just a different way to implement it?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, it's interesting that it lets you automate kind of role assignment, essentially, is what's going on there, right? Like credential.
Yeah, as permission. Far as I could tell, I haven't tried it yet because I didn't put the identity crawler into the Slack connector when I did it. I wanted to see what it would do. But yeah, it sort of sounds like what you're describing there.
Yeah, there's a good diagram further in the article that kind of goes into what they've got set up here.
Let's try. Oh man, I'm really, whoa. I'm on the wrong screen here. I'm changing the size of the what's on the screen. Let me see here.
But essentially it kind of details the way you would set up a system like this. Yeah. Like you have, for example, you have a set of customers who are going to make a query to some sort of API, usually an HTTPS post, that's going to hit a Lambda function, and then that's going to your agent. And your agent has access to a couple of different things via those crawlers usually, right?
Yeah.
So there's an API schema you can assign. So that kind of tells it if it's looking for a certain piece of information, it might be able to find it here, like call this API to get X info. For example, like we were saying, bookings info, you can call a specific API, so it'll get the actual correct data from like a microservice system. But it can also go into the knowledge base service, which will crawl data in S3 or use OpenSearch to kind of ingest organizational data or things you might want it to just have general knowledge of.
Okay. So yeah, I'm going to put you on the spot because that's my thing every week. So we've got Q, right? Which, like I said, we've been playing around with, and I'll make sure in the newsletter, again, another reason to subscribe to the newsletter, I'll share the links off to the content that we've created there. But Q is sort of what you're describing here, and I might be wrong, but Q seems like it's providing us with a layer of abstraction. I've pulled up the diagram, I think, that you were mentioning in the article. And to me, this seems that it's farther down in the weeds, like this bedrock agent idea, where you've got the ability to do a lot more, fine tune things. You have more granular control over stuff. Whereas Q seems to be a higher level, like more a higher level of abstraction that allows you to do something. But I don't think you have as many layers as you could, or levers that you could pull, as the way you're describing it here. Knowing what you know about the two, is that a fair, I don't want to overgeneralize, but is a fair way to think about the two of them?
I think so, yeah. Q will take away a lot of this setup for you, right?
Okay.
You just have to point it at the data sources you want it to crawl. You don't have to set up an S3 or anything, right?
One like second. That, right? Alexa.
Oh.
Stop.
We have a cameo.
Speaking of assistants. I don't know if you could hear that on your side, but the echo on my desk here is telling me I got to go talk to somebody. So basically what you've got here is sort of a service that allows you to get in and I'll use the word tinker. I know it's not right, but you've got a lot more ability to kind of customize it versus maybe something like Q that, at least in its current iteration, still gives you a lot of flexibility, but maybe less control over some of the underlying mechanisms, the way it's working.
Yeah, exactly. Less knobs to turn in Q, I would say, it seems.
Yeah. That's by no means meant to dissuade anybody from trying Q. I've really enjoyed the process of working through it, and I'll continue to build stuff out. I think I'm going to try to attach it to Jira. You know, the funny thing is, though, and we'll wrap up with this last thought and we'll start our weekend here, but it's really weird. So I've got it tied to the website. I've got it tied to Slack, and I'll tie it to Jira, where we've got all of our work items and stuff. I'm having a hard time, like when it was tied to just to the website, and I could say, tell me about service X, and it would come back and it would say blah, right? Oh, Orbit Audit is a review of your AWS account for security best practices, blah, blah, blah. And I had my, I've really struggled with, okay, I've got this other data source. I've got like, when I set the crawl up, it says, when do you want us to crawl from? So like on the Slack crawler, right? So I said, well, we could go back years, I guess, in theory, because it's a paid subscription. But I'm like, geez, let's just do the beginning of February. So it crawled, I don't know, let's say 2,500-ish docs or messages or whatever you want to call them, right?
Right.
And I had a really hard time trying to figure out, now that I've got those chat messages in there, I know I can't, like, it's not to say, show me the conversation I had with Travers on February 26th. That's not what it's for. But I had a really hard time to try to figure out, like, what's the benefit of having that additional
the Slack integration
in there? Like, what's it going to use that information for to articulate answers to the questions that I'm asking?
That's a good question. I wonder if you could get it to, like, spin up a channel or something.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I did get it to answer one time, and I had to be really careful because we do have information in Slack that I didn't really want on the stream, right? So what I was doing is I was going between, you know, my PyCharm window, and I'd run a query or I'd ask it a question and just make sure it was safe and bring it back. And I did have it. I can't remember exactly what I asked it about. I think I asked it about a best practices multi account organization deployment or something like that, and it actually pulled information. It showed me the source, and the source was from a channel where we were having a conversation, or people were having a conversation about what a multi-account control tower implementation of AWS might look like, and it gave me.
Oh.
It didn't have context, right? It didn't say Travers said X, Brett said Y, but it gave me a summary of the best practices. So, and when I looked, the source of that was a channel from Slack. So
that's something.
Yeah, I wasn't able to replicate it again. Like, I couldn't think of any other ways to frame a question that ever pulled anything else that referred to a conversation in Slack somewhere, like a channel in Slack. But I'm gonna tie Jira to it just so that we can, but I can't wrap my head around what's it doing with that information, and how do I get value out of it once it's in the, what do they call it, the index, right? I don't know.
We'll have to poke around a bit. Maybe if it had a bigger time scale, you could go and query and ask for summaries about certain topics. I mean, yeah, that's interesting. I'm sure they'll come out with some kind of bespoke integration at some point.
Yeah, I think, you know, some of the value here, we were talking about this earlier on today too, is some of the value might just be helping people, like what I just said, helping people understand, well, what the heck do I do with this once it's connected? Like,
right.
What do I actually ask it? Well, like, how do I prompt engineering? We talked about it a couple of weeks ago, right? Obviously, my brain just wasn't thinking of the engineering the correct prompts. There we go. Let's go with that. I could not engineer a prompt that would give me some information back that could verify that indeed we were grabbing information from the Slack in the index, or Slack channels in the index. But anyways, so there we go. That is another week of Talking Cloud. Anything before we wrap up?
All right. No, that's everything for me, I think.
All right. So I've got like three shameless plugs here this week. We will be back on Tuesday evening, 7 p.m., back on the Twitch channel as normal. Probably still working on Q. We'll see kind of where we are at that point, but I think there's still some more work to be done there. We do have at the end of the month, I think it's the last Thursday of March, which would be... Mm-hmm. March 20-something? Let's just go last Thursday of the month. We are going to do an intro to AWS webinar. Keep your eyes open 28th. For that. The 28th, okay. We'll keep you updated in the newsletter. And then outside of that, I guess we'll call it and enjoy your weekend.
All right. Have a good weekend, everyone.
One last thing. I have an outro screen, too.
Now that's exciting.
Fingers crossed. Let's see if it works. Bye for now, everybody.
Bye-bye.